Dr. Douglas, a defense analyst, is author of The Soviet Theater Nuclear Offensive and other books.
It only seemed appropriate to me as I was thinking about this morning that in a conference on disaster unpreparedness this summer, we at least ought to have one talk on intelligence. And so this is the gap I'm filling this afternoon. I would like to talk about a very small segment of one of my favorite subjects, chemical and biological warfare. This particular area that I'm going to talk about is one that very little, if anything, has been written about it. Yet, it is, to my way of thinking, probably the area of greatest concern that I have encountered in 40 years. The subject is mind control in covert operations using pharmaceutical drugs. Now, there are really two main areas I want to address because there are some people that have a considerable knowledge of the U.S. program, and yet there are others that are not, and I wanted to start from a common understanding of what it was all about, and that's the project MKUltra. And I'm going to present this in a way that I consider will give you an idea of the problems in dealing with this subject. This particular area, I'm using MKUltra in sort of a generic sense to really sweep in a large number of programs under different labels that can all be viewed as part of this MKUltra philosophy, if you will. As a program, MKUltra itself began in April 1955 and was most of it terminated, we are told, in about 1963, with some residual components extending to the early 1970s. How true that is, I'll let you gauge for yourself as we go on. There's absolutely, for the most part, no details on what was accomplished in this program, which is very large. Fortunately, I've also quite a bit of information, and this is where the heart of the talk will lie, really, on a Soviet counterpart to MKUltra. This becomes very interesting because there's a tremendous, in comparison, amount of data on what they accomplished and what they did in the early phases of their program, and I think most of you will find it quite shocking and quite surprising, and will raise in everybody's mind a question of why haven't we heard about this? Because in reality, almost nothing has been written about it, nor are there any details really available on it. And then I'll also talk about some findings. So let's start off with MKUltra. What was it? It was a very secret program begun in the CIA in April 1953, and as I said, extended for anywhere from 10 to 20 or 25 years, depending on who you want to listen to. What I want to run through is what were the objectives to give you an idea of its coverage, security demands, which are very important, the size of the program, and the manner in which it was terminated or discredited. Sample objectives. I pulled out about a half a dozen out of about three times that many. For example, one objective is to develop things that will cause mental confusion, promote illogical thinking and impulsiveness, cause a recipient to discredit himself, facilitate hypnosis, produce shock and confusion, alter personality structure, induce amnesia respecting events immediately preceding and during the use of mind control drugs. Now, in most cases, what I'm using are direct quotes from CIA documents. Only occasionally have I paraphrased this to get them on one line or two lines, whatever the case may be. Okay, let's talk about security demands. And here, the place to start out is by recognizing why MKUltra was, according to their logic, conceived. And it was because the agency is engaged in unethical and illicit activities, this could have serious repercussions both domestically and internationally. Therefore, what do? You form a special program, MKUltra, as an umbrella under which these activities will be performed. And what do then? You hide the project from any public awareness or congressional oversight. You do this also to satisfy the reluctance of scientists who would like to be involved but aren't about to be involved if their name can be tied to it. And finally, you eliminate any paper trail that later might prove embarrassing. In other words, there was no paper trail. There were no real records on what was being done or by whom. Okay. Goes on. Use false documentation, false descriptions in the documentation where you have to have some identification. And this came out in testimony under oath, and it's really quite hilarious. But it showed, it was a clear statement that, well, you really couldn't tell what was done according to what was written because the things were not correlated. They did not write in the project descriptions what was actually going on. Conduct sensitive operations overseas. The reason is this avoids congressional oversight. If you do it in a place like Great Britain, where a lot was done, you have third-party agreements, which are agreements between the United States and Great Britain that nobody will expose this unless the other country agrees. And that stops Congress from ever knowing what was going on or any other agency because it's restricted. Also, a number of the experiments were done in U.S. military facilities, secret bases or secret facilities within the bases in places like Germany, Korea, Japan, Vietnam. Again, no oversight, no accountability. Reminds us of a few of the things that are happening today. Finally, you minimize the knowledge of the program within the CIA. And as came out in a number of hearings in the mid-1970s, the common belief and statement was that there were only two people in the agency who had an overall idea of what was happening. That's what was stated. Whether you believe it or not may depend upon the size of the program, which I think is very important to understand. So let's go and take a look at the size. Now, we're talking about the program as it's presented in the CIA documentations, and occasionally it's mentioned in a few books. We're talking about 185 researchers, 80 institutes, 44 colleges and universities, top ones, top researchers, incidentally, research foundations, hospital clinics, penal institutions. That's usually where the discussion ends. And what is usually left off, but I include it here because it's very important, is also several pharmaceutical companies. For example, Lilly and Merck are two names prominently mentioned. What is also left out, generally, is the contribution of a number of government agencies, such as the NIH and the NIMH and the Army Laboratories, the Navy and Air Force, and, of course, the coordinated activities with researchers overseas and the use of overseas facilities in particular to do things such as terminal experiments. Now, how did it terminate? Really, it sort of terminated, we are led to believe, in the mid-70s as a result of a number of congressional hearings. The project was sort of accidentally exposed and material surfaced that concentrated attention on a bunch of LSD experiments which looked like a bunch of glorified fraternity pranks almost, except, of course, a couple people were killed in the process. But it was not good science by any stretch of the imagination. So they say the project was shut down in 63 with a few add-on parts of it extending to 73. It was impossible really to go into it in any great deal because all the files had been destroyed, they said, and Helms said that he had directed them to be destroyed just before he left office in 1973. Curiously, after a couple years, they found some boxes gathering dust with a good 16,000 pages in them. And those were turned over under an FOIA information request to Marks, John Marks, who wrote, based on them, The Search for the Manchurian Candidate. So let me give you his impression of what was accomplished. In his book, based on his analysis and the use of researchers in this analysis of these 16,000 pages. It's now up to 20,000 pages. And this is what he wrote. CIA officials claimed basically nothing of substance was learned during the 25-odd years of research. Direct quote. At the same time, he recognizes, well, that proposition is false, but no one in Congress pressured the CIA to produce the data. You have really no accountability whatsoever here. And finally, based on the data that was turned over, they said the CIA data on Russian accomplishments was extremely poor based on second or third-hand rumors and unsupported statements. I can't prove it, but as far as I'm concerned, that's a direct and unequivocal lie, as was the first. But nobody sought to look into these things anymore. And it's a lie based on the number of activities that had taken place and some information that was collected prior to MKUltra, when the program was really started under the OSS, which was the predecessor of the CIA, the Office of Strategic Studies. Okay. Looking back and sort of stepping away from this a little bit, here's my impression of it. There are two main fields of investigation. One was psychological and psychiatric manipulation. This was the area where they were deliberately splitting personalities, causing people to have multiple personalities and other things of similar natures. There's an excellent book that's been written in the past few years by Dr. Colin Ross decrying this work. It's called Bluebeard Bird, which was the predecessor of Artichoke, which was the predecessor of MKUltra. A very good book. The second field of examination was pharmacology, which is our subject here this afternoon. On this, there has been almost nothing whatsoever available. I have put the main things that's available right down here, which is 6 drugs were in use in 33 operations by 1957. By 1961, 100 operations. And then by 1963, most of the work was terminated. Well, why would it be terminated? It's growing. Was nothing of substance accomplished? I'd say this has to be nonsense. Is it the result of incompetence or deliberate sabotage? Or are the results just successfully hidden? And I say it's nonsense because, as I will describe later, this was in a period when the whole area of psychopharmacology was being born and was expanding at an explosive rate. Key question, should we care? And of course, there's really, other than some very disturbing aspects of the multiple personality creation that they were into, if we don't know what they accomplished, we don't know whether we can care or should care. And this is where the next material becomes very valuable, material on what the Russian program, which was really bearing fruit at the same time, a little bit in advance, and we're going to look at a number of their accomplishments. The project is named FLATA, or FLUTE, to use the translation. What I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about background to set the stage for this program, and then I'll talk about their capabilities, what they accomplished, actual operations, some of their interests in technology that I've been able to dig out in the late 60s, the program as it was confirmed by Colonel Alebikov in 1992, and also the primary sources. Let me say a word about those right now because they're very critical, and I'm sure everybody will want to know something about them. The primary source was General Jan Sena, who defected in 1968. The important thing about this gentleman is he was one of the 5 most knowledgeable people in Czechoslovakia. He was in the decision-making hierarchy, the only defector we have ever had that was that high in the system. He was the chief of staff to the Minister of Defense. He ran the Secretariat of the Defense Council, and the Defense Council is the primary decision-making body in questions of defense, intelligence, counterintelligence, foreign policy, and the economy. It is higher than the Politburo. And he had a whole raft of other positions, and he had a fabulous memory. And he had a record of providing excellent information to both U.S. and Allied intelligence whenever he was asked. The second source, which is very good in confirming in general terms and some specifics what Sanus said in recent days, and that's the gentleman who we talked about 4 years ago when I gave a talk on biological warfare, and we heard something about yesterday, who was the deputy director of Biopreparat from 1987 until 1992 when he too defected. And what he had to say you'll find very interesting, I think, also. To start out with, what do we really mean in the area we're talking about in terms of mind control? Because most people will say, well, we don't control minds, and I think that's absolutely correct. I agree with that. What we're talking about is the ability to alter mental attitudes, mood, and influence behavior. We're talking about some operations where all that is necessary is to slip a particular drug into somebody's drink or food or put it in the air, and you don't have to do anything else. The drug will take care of it. I'll describe many operations like this. The majority of operations are actually complex. They're psychological operations involving trained specialists in military intelligence, in which drugs are administered as sort of the grease that helps the wheel go round. It's not just drugs that work in these operations. It's a whole psychological entrapment, if you will. And I'll give some examples of this. Finally, we'll talk about operations, some of which are over in an hour or two, and others that may extend for several years or more. Let me give you an example of some of the effects. These are all, now we're going out to really, I stick very closely to what the particular source told me, in this case, General Saint. I used his words on the effects as he was talking about them, in which he had firsthand access, and I've only used the places where he had firsthand access to the things, so this is all extremely credible information. For example, just a few of them, drugs that would make people passive or alternatively aggressive, cause people to reveal secrets and not remember having done so. Well, this is very important in cases of espionage, where you want somebody to reveal a secret but not remember he's done it afterwards, because then he can pass a polygraph test. Cause people to speak their minds without regard for the consequences. Now, I just ask you, supposing you have a politician who's running for office that you don't like and you want to destroy, you know, could you ask for anything better?
Kerry?
A drug that could be used to cause people to commit suicide or alternatively go insane. And finally, ones that will lead to assassinations or assist in assassinations that mimic natural diseases or accidental causes. Now, this all broke out in what I'd call the birth of mind control drugs in the 40s and early 50s. In the 40s in World War II, there was a lot of experimentation here in the Soviet Union and Germany, particularly on things like marijuana, LSD, heroin, peyote, mescaline. The primary thrust in the United States activities during these 40s was really on two things: interrogation drugs, drugs that could get people to reveal secrets, and alternatively, the problem of how do we keep our own people who are captured from revealing secrets to the enemy. The change came in 1950, really, and this is really regarded in the books I've gone through as the birth of psychoneurophharmacology, and there's sort of two events that are key. One was the development, or not the development, the understanding of the effects, constructive effects of lithium in treating mental illness. That was 1949, and also chlorpromazine in 1951. Within a few years, we have an organized development of psychoactive drugs for use in psychiatry and medicine. And this led really in by 57 in such things as imipramine, antidepressant, Librium, that's when it came out, and the benzodiazepines started coming out in that period of time. Now, this was so clear, and why I say, how could nothing have been accomplished? It was so clear that in 1961, there was a large symposium directed to look at mind control and the potentials, where it was leading. And let me go to a couple of opening statements made by the provost. This was University of California at San Francisco Medical School that held this conference, Control of the Mind Symposium. Provost was John Saunders, and he made the first statement here. Here at our disposal, to be used wisely or unwisely, is an increasing array of agents that can manipulate human beings. The new techniques include social, ethical, and religious complications of great consequence. There is, especially among thoughtful physicians, a deep sense of disquiet. It is now possible to act directly on the individual to modify his behavior, instead of, as in the past, indirectly, through modification of the environment. This symposium was of such great interest that they couldn't handle it in their auditorium. They had closed-circuit television to a whole bunch of classrooms in San Francisco. Even that wouldn't handle it. They had to establish an overflow operation across the bay in Berkeley. It was very well recognized, and I might say it was well attended by Czech intelligence agents also. Let's talk about some early applications. These are all 1949, 1950, 51, 52 time frame. The one that's usually used to justify MKUltra are really Cardinal Manzanti, who you may recall gave unusual confessions that nobody believed that he made on his own. He had to have been drugged in about 1949, and also on what happened to our Korean War POWs. But let's talk about what happened with Dr. Zucker and Cardinal Manzanti. Dr. Zucker was his personal private secretary. And the secret police arrested him, and they administered drugs for him over a period of 2 days. They then brought him back to the Cardinal's restaurant residence, and it was very interesting the way in which his behavior was described. He was described to me by somebody who was there as unlike the secretary, who was usually a very dour and serious person. He came in sort of on a skip dance. He was sort of laughing and chuckling, saying, "Oh, I've seen the truth, I've seen the truth." And he proceeded to lead the secret police to every single one of the places where the Cardinal's secret papers were hidden. And the police picked up the papers. Next day, they arrested the Cardinal. And about a month later, they put him in jail. They put him on trial, and he confessed to everything. Now, a couple of things that are very interesting. First, when we think of Dr. Zucker's reaction, let me show you a quote on a truth drug, TD, that comes out of the papers before they were so severely classified by MKUltra during the OSS. And here's what the paper talked about. TD was a derivative of marijuana, as I recall. I said, the truth drug appears to relax all inhibitions and to deaden the areas of the brain which govern an individual's discretion and caution. A sense of humor is accentuated to the point where any statement or situation can become extremely funny to the subject. The reaction will be one of great loquacity and hilarity. This is exactly the way in which Dr. Zucker appeared. Now let's go to Cardinal Manzanti's memoirs. Interesting quote. He says, he's describing his time in jail. My powers of resistance gradually faded. Apathy and indifference grew. More and more, the boundaries become true between true and false. Reality and unreality seemed blurred to me. I began to think that somehow I might very well be guilty. Very interesting. Most interesting when we compare it against the actual trial of Joseph Smirkovsky, who was an old-time loyal Czech communist who got wrapped up in the purges. And he was later rehabilitated, and Jan Sena was given the task of rehabilitating him. And Jan describes how he brought Smirkovsky into his office, and he was standing in attention. He says, "Relax." And he gave him a glass of vodka and sit down, let's chat. And after a while, Smirkovsky told him what happened. He said, "I was arrested, and they brought me in. They gave me, after breakfast, they fed me drugs, and then they had me read my confession. And then after that, they had me repeat it, and then corrected mistakes. And they did this after lunch. And they did it after breakfast the next morning. Then they put him on trial, and he made his confession. And they did it again in the afternoon for the tape," as John said. And he said, "You know, John, when I was under trial, I actually believed what I was saying. And they took me back to the cell, and I could not remember what had just happened. And I didn't begin to even remember it until later that night as I was falling asleep." This was the first generation of the Czech friendship drugs in operation. They used the same drugs on the well-known Czech Gustav Husák, who also, under those drugs, implicated people they wanted implicated, who were also thrown in jail. Bishop Stefan Trochka. The one thorn in the side of the communists was the religious leaders. So in about 1959, they had an edict that all the religious leaders will sign a loyalty oath to the Communist Party, where they would put the Communist Party above the Vatican. And this particular bishop wouldn't sign it. And the Soviet advice to the Czechs was break their backs and show them the way to communism. A very subtle technique. And the way they handled it with the bishop was they had his mother arrested on shoplifting and thrown in jail. And when he showed up, they had some refreshments with drugs. And after extended conversation, he agreed to sign the loyalty oath. They released his mom, and he became a full-time apologist for the Communist Party. Korean War POWs. Many people will remember, I'm sure, the newsreels we saw in the mid-50s on U.S. prisoners of war that were talking very bad about conditions in the United States under democracy and extolling the virtues of communism under the North Koreans. This was not the result of the Chinese brainwashing we've been talked about or told for years. This was the result of the first generation friendship drugs which were on trial and experimented on U.S. POWs during the Korean War. Let's shift now to a category of drugs, very interesting, called self-destruct drugs. And these are you don't want to really kill people because they'll just move somebody into the organization, the guy might be better. What you want to do is you want to take out the whole organization. You want to discredit him. You want to make it very difficult. Much better than killing the person outright most of the time. This goes for military operations as well, where you want to, if you take out a key officer, all they do is replace him. But if you make him so he doesn't make decisions well, then you've sabotaged the whole operation. Okay, promote aggressive behavior. You can understand how that will degrade a person's effectiveness in a leadership position. Cause people to speak their mind without regard for the consequences. We said something about this in terms of the politician, but let me give you an example that was used in Czechoslovakia. There was a meeting of the Defense Council, and to demonstrate this drug, the Minister of Interior had his deputy there just to bring him along, give him a chance to see how the Defense Council operated. And at a tea break, they put drugs in his tea. And as John said, the minister said to him, "Now just don't break the place up, Husky. as we go back into session a half hour later. And they started going into session, and one of the first things Husky does is he raises his hand and says, gentlemen, maybe it would be useful for us to talk about some of the things that usually don't come to the Defense Council. Like, for example, the time that we tried to get the entire German cabinet to resign en masse and the operation backfired on us. Nobody asked why or told you people that. At this point, the Minister of Interior stepped in and he says, now, Husky, let's not get into foreign operations here. And Husky's reply was, see what I mean? There's a lot of things that don't come to this august council. And he would have lost more than his job doing something like that. It was the drugs that did it. Caused paranoia. I'll give a good example of this later, so let me pass by this. Destroy one's ability to think logically. Strictly based on motions shifting around back and forth. What does this do to a leader? Okay, let's look at some actual operations involving a different type of a drug, which is a loosen-the-tongue type of drug. This is the type of drug that allows one to speak when he knows he shouldn't be speaking. The North Vietnamese came for assistance prior to the Vietnam War, and Czechoslovakia was one of their key places and probably the key assistance they had in that war at the direction of the Soviets. And early on, about 1962, prior to the invasion, they were over making plans for the types of assistance and help they needed. And John was, of course, overlooking the whole thing from his position as Secretary of the Defense Council. And the Czech intelligence people complained to him and said, we can't get these guys to talk about their invasion plans, and we need that information. So John went to the medical military intelligence people in charge of the drugs and said, put a little bit more pepper in their food tomorrow. So they did. And the North Vietnamese delegates told them everything they wanted to know about the invasion. No problem whatsoever. The collection of corruption information. Often there are various contingencies of parliamentarians or staff officers that visit various countries such as Czechoslovakia. They spend time in Prague, and as you well understand, they have a little social hour to get to know each other. And quite often what they would do is they'd feed these delegates a little pills during the recreation time, and through a very gentle nudging in different areas, very soon everybody was trying to outdo everybody else in talking about the various skeletons in the various politicians' closets. And he said Joe, it was really interesting. With one person you get a lot of information out, but when you have two or three getting this thing, he said each one ends up wanting to outdo the other. And it's like a flood of all these skeletons coming out of the closets. Espionage, very important. There's a whole new phase of espionage that entered into the scene, beginning really roughly in about 1958 and expanding really into the 60s. The way this does not invalidate prior espionage, but it's a whole new field. And what they would do is they would first identify what scientific developments did they want information on. Second, what Western scientists were the best ones to contact to get the information. Third, who are the Czech scientists who could meet with the Western scientists and understand what they were telling him. When they had this figured out, then military intelligence was given the task of inviting the American or Western scientists to a conference somewhere, preferably in Eastern Europe, but Western Europe was fine too. They would then arrange for an invitation to be sent to the Czech scientist. Czech intelligence would be at the conference. They would arrange an accidental meeting of the two and a dinner that they would get to talk about things, improve relations, and they would put the right things in the right food at the right time. And then the Czechs would ask the Americans or other Western scientists about particular developments and ask them to explain it, and it all came out. And what is important, as I mentioned before, was the Western scientists didn't recall revealing any secrets or anything or even the conversation on this material afterwards. Good example, British bankers. The Brits devalued the pound, as you will recall, I think it was about 1964, 65. Czechoslovakia knew about this from the Bulgarians a week prior to the devaluation. They didn't take any action because the Soviets were concerned that it might be a deception. But it did take place, and about 2 weeks afterwards, some of the top Czech officials were having lunch with particular Tudor Zivkov, who was the head of Bulgaria, and one of them asked him how they got the information on the devaluation of the pound. And this is what Tudor answered, as John recalls with his fabulous memory, I should say. He said, "We are sometimes very conservative. I do not have to recruit a bank president. It is enough for him to have dinner with me and just tell me about the British financial plans." Wonderful way. Complex operations. What we've been discussing is some very simple ones. Let's talk about some things more complex. Destruction of the UAR, the United Arab Republic. This was a merger, a developing merger of the Arab countries into a coalition, and the Soviets didn't like this. They wanted to keep the countries fragmented. So they gave the Czechs the job of breaking it up between Egypt and Syria, which was where the Czechs had good operational assets there. So what the Czechs did is they fed the aggressive type of drug to Egyptian generals in or going to Syria. At the same time, they spiked the food of Syrian generals who were interacting with these people with a drug that made them very paranoid. Okay, well, you can imagine the explosive mixture. Well, it blew up, and that ended the UAR. And several years later, one of the top secretaries in the Czech party had a lunch with an Egyptian general and a Syrian general. He wanted to sort of play a cat-and-mouse game with them to talk about this, and Jan was at the lunch also. And it was quite apparent that the Egyptians, neither of them knew what ever happened. They couldn't explain how they all of a sudden the thing just blew up on them. And the Egyptians said, we thought everything was going fine. We could never understand it. And the Syrian general said, we couldn't either, except all of a sudden we recognized that we weren't going to tolerate those imperialist Egyptians coming in and running our country. Very interesting. Neither had any idea what happened. I skipped the annual attaché open houses. Every year they would have various open houses at which they would invite the different defense attachés that were in Prague. And at these things there might be, a dozen attachés or something present. There was a collection plan against every single one of these attachés. There was two GRU, military intelligence people, there to work with that particular attaché, with each of the attachés. In some cases, it would just get them to talk. Some cases, they want to talk about particular things. Different types of things, different drugs were administered, and there was medical intelligence doctors there to handle any problems. And then based on each one's information drawn out of the conversations, there were always, a leash set up, another meeting, to then exploit it and go into these things further. And at the one meeting that John recalled where there was an accident, one of the American attachés had a bad reaction to one of the drugs. They whisked him into another room, explained it away as just an overreaction of the drinks that he had been taking, that he had just gotten drunk, and they took him back to his home. But it was very important. They gave him an antidote to the drug that had been administered to him first, I should say. These things happened. Everything isn't perfect. It seems overly perfect the way I'm describing it, but there are problems, and you'd recognize that, I'm sure, because drugs act differently sometimes with different people, as you all know better than I do. Discredit a British politician. There was a wing in one of the Labour Party, I believe, in Great Britain, that the Soviets believed was going in the wrong direction, and they decided they had to bring an end to it and rebuild it with their people. But they had to get rid of this top guy. Well, they found out that he was a closet homosexual. So what they did is they planned to exploit this. What they did is they fed a loosen-the-tongue drug to his private secretary, who knew. And they then planted a number of people, intelligence agents, to ask leading questions of the guy when he was in a meeting so as to let this all come out naturally as an inadvertent disclosure when the press was present. At the same time, they fed to the politician an aggressive drug. And he was normally a very calm person. And this made him very overreactive. And he attacked people in his party, the people who were there, the press, and it just broke up that wing of the party. It accomplished their mission. Talk about some military applications. Ones that would make pilots afraid to fly. Drugs that would cause sloppy maintenance. You may think back to the Vietnam War and recall there was a spate of airplane accidents, particularly involving the F-111, if I recall. And there were concern about it being ground avoidance radar that was doing it. That may have contributed, but there was also a major study of all those accidents made by the Czech intelligence services to determine how many of those were due to the drugs they were testing on the American pilots and the American air bases at that precise time. Another two that are very interesting, one that promoted desertion and one that caused chaos. The chaos drug was particularly important for being able to destroy an entire military unit, such as a battalion, without firing a shot. They had tested this particular drug upwind of one battalion to get that effect, to prove it worked. They also tested it upwind of a small village, and they had to move military people into the village to stop the village from destroying itself, the people in the village. One of the intended uses of this also was to put it into the water supply of the British Parliament prior to a war breaking out. One of the questions that comes out, well, where do you get ideas for some of these things? Where do you pick up a lead that gets you into the chemistry? And in this case, I think that it's so close to one event that let me give you an idea of where these types of things can come from very easily. And this takes us into St. Anthony's Fire, which quite a few of you probably will recall from medical school. It was first known in the Middle Ages, entire villages stricken with a horrifying madness, scenes of unbelievable chaos as hundreds became psychotic at almost a single moment, and it erupted in this little French city in 1951 in August. People thought it was due to ergot in the wheat supply, and they thought it was sort of an LSD type of derivative that came out. As the inventor of LSD, Albert Hoffman, told me over lunch, he did not believe that. He thought it was due to, a mercury-based fomicide that was used on the grain. He thought that was the cause. But at any rate, this was widely publicized. It was in the newspapers all across Europe. It was in the New York Times. And it's inconceivable to me that the Soviets would have missed this and not gone out to see it. And what happened? These are some of the reports on it. Patients brought screaming into hospital. A man and a wife chasing each other around the kitchen table with knives. A woman absolutely certain her children had been drawn and quartered and were going to be made into sausages. A man clutching his head because of the red snakes that were eating his brains. This is the type of things that were taking place. It all happened after a result of bread that came from a particular single bakery that had to buy all its bread flour from one particular plant. Another couple of things here that's very interesting with respect particularly to the desertion drug. Emil fought with a fury that held off seven men. They got a straitjacket on him and then watched in amazement as he ripped the canvas. He repeated this feat seven times. They tied him to a cot with giant leather straps. He gnawed his way through, lost several teeth. He desperately wanted to escape the tigers in his room that were ready to pounce. This drug was being tested on American prisoners of war in Laos. It's one of the few times that they escaped from the very special prisons, this was a totally separate set that was established to use American POWs as guinea pigs in chemical and biological warfare experiments and in the drug development programs. Six guys escaped while they were testing this drug. It was so effective that to continue the testing, they had to put shackles on the men and stake them to the ground. Did it come from this? I don't know. But it certainly is an indication of what could have happened. drugs under development, some of the things they're working on, and let me give you some examples in terms of their the way they were tested. Torture drugs were underway. As the minister of the German, as the defense minister of Germany explained to Jan on the fishing trip, he says, this drug is 10 times better than any of the old physical means of communication. Inhibit the decision-making ability. A lot of these were tested in prisons. This was one. So was the torture drug in Czechoslovakia. The decision-making drug was so effective that the prisoners that were on it at night could not decide whether to use a fork or a spoon in eating their dinner. No worries, no cares drugs. Prisoners could not care less whether they had to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And this was true 2 years after they had been given the drug. Another one, which is a third generation in the friendship drugs, is kind of interesting. How they operated this is they infiltrated the prison with military intelligence agents. And these guys went in as prisoners, and a few of the prisoners were targeted, and the mission of these guys was to espouse a particular position to the prisoner. The prisoner was covertly administered or fed this drug. And this process, the drug administered, you know, the point of view expressed, this goes on for a couple days, 3 days, and by about the third, fourth day, the prisoner has accepted the position, quite often a political position, of the GRU agents. And they had tested this, and after 2 years, they still had the same position adopted as their own. This was also used on some unfriendly Finn executives. They were so mad at the Soviet Union, they wouldn't even go there. So they were invited to a conference, 10-day conference in Czechoslovakia. They did the same thing there. They fed them the drugs for about a couple days. They had people around them espousing telling them that the Soviets really weren't such bad guys. You know, they were always getting a bum rap. If they could just get to know them, you know, they'd find out that they were only that way because they had so many aggressive people on their borders. Sound familiar? After a week and a half, this particular individual had become almost pro-Soviet. And so he went back to Finland, and he was no longer a problem. Let me sort of summarize the types of things that information that I got from Jan Sanna over about a 15-year period of debriefing him. We went over about 20 different families of drugs, 50 operational examples, of which I've just given you some smattering. Different effects, durations, delivery means. The strategy, R&D growth, when funding things started, the increase at different times, cooperation with different countries, and complementary programs, such as the program introduced in 1962 to greatly increase the capability for infiltrating the Western media, and how this then ties in with the use of drugs in the same operation 4 years later. The reason for this is I can only touch on this stuff. It really is, you have to think about it for a long time before the implications really start coming out. And for those people who are interested in this, there is a paper that was the first one, only one published in the open press in the Medical Sentinel that I wrote 3 years ago. That there are some copies outside that I brought along. It's sort of like what I'm saying now, just a few examples of this and that. Everything that I really developed, with a few minor exceptions, is contained in the book Betrayed, which is why I brought copies of that outside. The reason it's in the book Betrayed, which looks at missing American POWs that didn't return and what happened to them, and the reason it's there is because the POWs were very important guinea pigs in this experimental program. They needed people ultimately to test who came from America, who had the American psyche, American education, American medical background of different classes of people, of course. because they were interested in how different drugs affected the intellectuals as opposed to the primitives, as they would call it. Very sophisticated research effort in this regard. Now, this is really just an illustration. Let me give you something that's totally independent of it that I dug out of the, many years ago, out of the Soviet and the East German classified military literature, even before I started doing this stuff. So the time frame of these quotations is 68 through 73. And I didn't understand them at the time, but I just pulled them out because they struck me as something that was important. Psychotoxins are weapons directed against the further existence of an independently thinking and acting society will enable the complete influence and control over human consciousness. Brave New World. Now possible to control the psychic state of populations, suppress the senses, induce contentment, promote self-resistance, cripple willpower, cause nervous shocks. You can use them on villages or cities in certain cases. This was interesting. The use of neuropeptides, synthetic peptides, one of the most malefic developments, and they're talking about low molecular weight proteins, 8 to 10 amino acids can already be produced in the laboratory. We will soon be able to mass produce them. This is 1967, actually. Think of that time frame in terms of this thinking. Substances that will cripple, render people incapable of fighting, cripple their willpower. We actually saw this in the Soviet script of exercises in 1978. Through use of psychotoxins, large portions of the population can be made incapable of action for a certain period of time. Continuation of that same quote. Jump ahead to 1979. Now, here are some statements that I called out of the Soviet Military Encyclopedia that was just published that year. Neurotropic toxins are toxic proteins. Their harmful effect is based upon their capability to inhibit the membrane receptors responsible for nerve impulse transmission. They can be used as an aerosol or in solid liquid state and can be used in combat and for sabotage purposes. Let's come up to 1992. Biopreparat, we heard some words about this a few days ago. This is information provided by Colonel Alebikov, who was the deputy head of Biopreparat. The massive biological warfare program, as explained earlier, some 50,000 employees, 41 major facilities, dozens of weaponized agents, genetically engineered agents. They had 12, as I recalled, P4 facilities, each one 10 times larger than any of the ones we have, which at that time was at Dietrich and CDC. Now, here's where it gets interesting. He identified a covert KGB program, but he was unable to penetrate it. And what sparked his curiosity is he learned as he took over, shortly after he took over deputy head, that's his field was the research and development of Biopreparat, there was a guy working for him on his staff who was regarded as a pharmacological genius, was the words he used. But Alebikov couldn't find out what he did. And so he's one of those guys that sparked his curiosity. Well, he worked hard on this for several years, but very carefully, because you work too hard on something like this, it's the debt, you're ended. This is what he found out. As he indicated, the name, the translation is Flute. It was a large KGB program. Now, this is large according to a guy that ran a program of 55,000 engineers and scientists. So we're talking about tens of thousands of people. Sophisticated chemical biological warfare agents for KGB use. Peptides, psychotropic, neurotropic agents, his words, trigger psychological changes, alter mood and change behavior, sophisticated assassination weapons. And the origins extended back to the late 20s. I talked with Colonel Alebikov, now Ken Alebek, And we started talking about the development of actual facilities. The major development phase began in 1972, as he mentioned it, along with the facility names. And it is almost to the year that you would project a large building program in this area when I looked back at the budgetary processes as SANA had explained it and when they were approved and what the lead time was. It correlates completely with everything SANA says. And as far as I can see, it's sort of a general confirmation. There are others, but this is all I have time here for today. My findings over the years are as follows. Number one, the threat is indeed a mind-boggling threat from my perspective. There is no indication I have run into any place of any U.S. awareness. I have never run into anybody that knew anything really about MKUltra. And it's not surprising when you recognize that it's hard to see anything factual that has really been, or very little factual that has actually been released. It's all cover, lies, deception, what have you. I'll be done before that. I do believe there's a lot of intelligence, but that it is hidden or suppressed. It's also clear to me that there's a lot of knowledge around of what was accomplished and what happened here in this country between 1963 and today. It resides in the minds of living psychiatrists, psychologists, pharmacologists, and institutional files. So anybody that knows anybody that might know anything, see if they're interested in talking. Because we're not going to get it out of the government. Last point, the applications don't care whether you're using them against the enemy or your own people. One of the most important applications, I believe, in thinking back, that Jan didn't say, this is my deduction, of this drug by Soviet intelligence was in their takeover of the political system, which occurred in 1982 when the head of the KGB, Yuri Andropov, was made chairman of the Central Committee. That is an unthinkable thing. You've had three power centers in the Soviet Union: intelligence, the party, and the military. There is no way that people in the party system would accept the head of the KGB becoming the general secretary of the party. Unheard of. Unless there was a tremendous mechanism employed to change the mind and grease the wheels that made it all possible. I also think that when you look back at these things, you'll draw another conclusion, which I've drawn, which answers the question of why have the suicide bombers been so effective? Let me close off. Thank you very much, and we don't have much time for questions, but at least for those that are interested, all this material and a great deal more is in the book Betrayed that I received from Jan Sanin. Thank you.